we're going to move on now to the next segment about Gaza. Israel has declared areas of Gaza near its border to be no-go zones, citing security concerns, intended to prevent Palestinian militants from approaching the border fence to plant explosives. The no-go order also keeps Palestinian farmers from their fields. Indeed, up to 20% of Gaza's arable land is inaccessible to Palestinian farmers because it's now in the new buffer zone. In response to these land confiscations, and probably following the pattern that we've seen in the West Bank, Palestinians and foreign supporters have been marching toward the border to protest the restrictions. This past week, those particular protests turned deadly. A 21-year-old Palestinian, Ahmed Salem Deeb, was shot and killed by an Israeli sniper. And a few days earlier, three people were shot by Israeli military snipers, one of them Bianca Zamet, a member of the International Solidarity Movement, ISM, who was shot in her left thigh as she was filming one of the protests. Max Isle, a reporter who was at the protest, said that Ahmed died from a severed femoral artery from a hollow-tipped bullet that had ruptured the middle of his thigh, shredding it. And Max emailed me and said that they were convinced that this was not an accident, that this was a deliberate killing, and that indeed the shooting of the ISM activist Bianca Zamet was similarly carefully done, not to kill her indeed, but rather to just wound her and scare people away. So shortly before these demonstrations, I actually talked with Max by phone from Gaza. It's not the best audio in the world because the phone connection wasn't the best, but I thought it was an interesting conversation and I thought I would play it. This is Marilyn Kleinberg-Niemark for Beyond the Pale, and I'm talking with Max Isle, who you regular listeners may remember we last spoke to when he was the media representative for the Gaza Freedom March. Max, welcome to Beyond the Pale.
Thank you for having me.
Max, we're talking to you. You're currently in Gaza. We last spoke to you. You were in Cairo. It was some months back. How and when did you get into Gaza?
I got into Gaza on the 1st of March after waiting about 2 months in Cairo. I got in on a press pass. I'm doing journalism work here, and I had to wait until the border was officially open for international. And this is a strange, idiosyncratic way of them calling it officially open, because only two internationals passed through, and for the rest of the time, it was open for Palestinians and or VIPs. And so the border being open, it just means that someone high up in Cairo decided that the border was going to be open for specific people on a specific day.
Now, in Gaza, How are you managing? Where are you staying and so on?
I am managing okay. I mean, you know, life goes on here. So I have an apartment. I shop at supermarkets. I'm able to go to cafes and restaurants. All of this is well supplied. There are problems in terms of electricity. There are rolling blackouts. And a lot of places, including the place where I live, doesn't have a full-time backup generator. So you don't have reliable access to the internet or to power things. Sometimes you're sitting in the dark a little bit, but it's not so bad for me. But I am living the same way maybe 10% of the population lives at best, if not somewhat less than that. Most of the population is not living anything like how I'm living.
And that's because you've got money and you can pay in hard currency?
Yes, because I have money and I have a job, but most of the population here is unemployed and is totally reliant on the United Nations Relief and Works Agency for food and for medical care, for education, and they don't really participate very meaningfully in the money economy.
Now, we've heard for some years now about the lack of access to health care and to a wide range of consumer goods and the heavy reliance on the goods that come in through the tunnels. To what extent really have you seen the tunnels really making life possible for people?
Totally. What I've heard is between 80 and 90% of the commercial goods you see in the stores in Gaza are coming in through the tunnels. The tunnels are what enables what there is of an economy to function. So everything's reliant upon the tunnels. And in turn, that entails elevated prices because the tunnels are heavily taxed and there's a lot of transaction costs that are tacked on to the price of goods coming through the tunnels because it's not legalized, it's not regularized. So this makes things that would already be unaffordable even more unaffordable.
And with massive unemployment, it really means that it's really a minority of the population that benefits from the goods that come in through the tunnels. Would that be right?
Definitely. There's a very small sector of the population that can afford the stuff that comes in through the tunnels. For the rest of the population, they really can't afford it. And so they're forced into being totally reliant on charity. And this is a horrible situation to live your life relying on charity because you have no other option.
And you've reported, I think it was in Mondo Weiss, that many, many Gazans are dying from treatable illnesses.
Right. Cancer has become a major cause of death here. And it's treatable cancers. It's cancers where people, either if there were facilities here to treat them, which there aren't, because goods can't come in, you can't get the drugs and the technology needed to treat cancer, and you can't get a patient out with any regularity to the medical centers in Egypt or in Israel because of the blockade. So there have been several documented cases where people finally got their permit to cross through the Erez crossing into Israel, and what was permitted to cross was a corpse because they had died by them.
Mm-hmm. Max, we've heard about the massive destruction of infrastructure during Operation Cast Lead and the inability to rebuild that infrastructure because of limits on building supplies coming into the Gaza Strip. Have you observed that still being a problem?
Yeah, there's still huge buildings that are just destroyed in downtown Gaza. You're walking along the street and suddenly you see a building that just has a huge hole gashed in the middle of it. And of course, that building is no longer usable. And especially in the north, in Beit Lehi and Beit Hanun, there's just tons and tons and tons of buildings that just have holes gouged out of the sides. That may still be structurally stable in theory, but no one can live there because there's a hole in the wall, and you can't fix the hole in the wall because concrete costs five times what it should because it's not allowed in except through the tunnel. Same with metal. So it's extremely hard to do any sort of reconstruction. There's just tons of building projects here that are just stalled. They're just sitting there, and there's no one working on them because these are things that someone started building and just had to stop because almost no one can afford raw material costs.
And Max, what are the spirits of the people like?
I would say trauma just overwhelms the landscape, and everyone is still in trauma. Everyone, if you talk to them about the war, it's like it just happened. They have large families here. Everyone knows someone who died during the massacre, and their traumatized children draw pictures of just bombs falling on their cities. Just small children are drawing this, and it's very hard to find a psychological way out because there's no one for them to talk to who wasn't directly affected by the massacre and who isn't directly crushed psychologically by the siege. So they do what they can to rely on one another. And there are some individuals here, and a good amount of them, who are just amazingly resilient and are still resisting and are organizing and writing and marching into the buffer zone to face bullets. And these people are brave beyond belief. Just incredible, but this is not the majority. The majority is just kind of in shock and trauma and just trying to recover, but some of what's going on is ongoing, so it's very hard for them.
The siege has been going on. I think last month you've reported that it's longer than the siege of Leningrad was in World War II. It was over 1,000 days, and we've heard so much about many of the things you've described in this conversation. What surprised you when you actually got into Gaza? What was unexpected?
On a more banal level, just how beautiful Gaza is. You walk around and you'd think that if there were not the siege going on, if there were not a blockade and there were no occupation, Gaza is a beautiful place. And this is also my first time to Palestine, and people are just amazingly welcome, amazingly hospitable. spite of having so little and being under just this enormous duress, people are still just incredibly welcoming of foreigners. And, you know, they have no reason to think in many ways that the external world cares so much about them, but are still so welcoming to foreigners who are supportive of them. So this quite struck me. I mean, the other thing that has really struck me is just that I wasn't adequately prepared for. I'd read about it, but I didn't, you know, it didn't really hit me viscerally. It was just that the impact of the siege obviously has its many, many, many humanitarian and tangible facets, but just what it's doing is just kind of destroying them psychically. It's bearing down upon them. And you see this every day, every time you interact with someone. Not every time, but you can very frequently see the symptoms of this, and it's not quite what I expected to see. It's horrible.
Max, you're Jewish, right?
Yes.
Do folks know you're Jewish? And if so, how have they responded?
Certainly, of course, my friends know. You know, I don't hide it. You know, I don't introduce myself and say, well, you know, hey, Max, I'm Jewish. It'll come up or they'll find out, they'll Google me or see my work, and, you know, I make no secret of it.
Well, indeed, your blog is Jubonics, right?
Right. So as soon as someone knows who I am, it's very clear that I'm Jewish. People are aware that they have many allies in the West who are Jewish. And within Israel, there's some amazing groups within Israel, and they know they have their comrades in Berlin, and they know that a lot of the people marching there are the nonviolent mobilizations in Berlin are Jewish. They're aware, and my friends who have no hostility whatsoever, their issues are not with Jews, but with Israeli policies and kind of the motivating ideology behind them. For younger people, I would not say that they're anti-Semitic with the connotations that word conjures up, but one has to be honest and recognize the only Jewish people these people have any experience of are Jewish people who are killing them. Even these children are young men, you know, they're likewise not stupid, and they know that there are plenty of Jewish people on their side, that it's not a kind of systemic anti-Semitism abuse of the population. It's nothing like that at all. But there is kind of a certain, there's a way, certainly some wariness, a totally understandable wariness in some respects. Another thing that struck me as I came in here through the Rafah crossing, and foreigners do not pass through the Rafah crossing very often, so we were surprised. The Egyptian government hadn't cleared us. Hadn't informed Hamas that we were coming in. Someone from Hamas immediately sat down with me and the other person crossing through with me, and they offered us tea, of course, because this is a given to be offered tea or coffee. And, you know, we sat down, talked for a while. They kind of ran a preliminary security check. It took a couple hours. And one of the things he says, he's like, our problem is not with Jews and it is not with Americans. It's with Israeli policy and American policy. There is a spectrum of opinion, but people here are not bigots.
In the West, our image of living under a regime that's dominated by Hamas is that it's pretty heavy-handed and pretty religious and constraints on people's lives, particularly women and so on. Do you have a sense of that in Gaza, and to what extent, if it does exist, is the population resentful of it?
Without question, 10 years ago, before the Second Intifada, the society was not nearly so conservative, and a lot of the women were not wearing hijabs, and almost every woman you see now is wearing the hijab, the head covering, for example. There is certainly a level of resentment, and yeah, I mean, this is definitely the case. On the other hand, there are groups that are to Hamas's right in terms of social conservatism, and who are so angry at Hamas that they're not instituting a harsher system of enforced social conservatism. Some of what Hamas has to do is palliate these groupings that are further to the right, and these groupings also are calling for more forceful armed resistance to the occupation. So these issues are never totally separable from the occupation. You press down on anything and it distorts its shape. So that includes governments and societies and religious and cultural, the religion and culture of a people.
Do you meet many people who openly support Fatah?
I would not say openly, no. But then people may be wary of me. It's a small place. Everyone kind of knows one another. You know, not literally, necessarily, but 1.5 million people living in this very small space. There's kind of a knowledge of who people's families are and the lineage of that family and who the political allegiances may be of certain parts of that family. In terms of open support, I don't think so. It's not like people are like waving Fatah flags.
Right.
Not in the sense you're probably asking.
Max, are you regularly sending reports out on Jubonics, your blog?
Yes, yes. Almost every day.
Give me the URL.
It's just my name, www.maxajl.com.
Okay. Max Isle of Jubonics, currently in Gaza. Thanks so much for talking with us on Beyond the Pale.